Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Diana Isaacs, and Natalie Bellini, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve care. Produced by endocrinologynetwork.com, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on endocrinologynetwork.com.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm here with the wonderful, amazing Natalie Bellini. And we have, I think, a great episode today. We are going to discuss some recent hype in the news related to drugs like Ozempic, and Wegovy, and Mounjaro for weight loss being used by celebrities. And is that contributing to shortages? And then also there's been a slew of new guidelines that have come out related to diabetes, kidney disease, and automated insulin delivery. And so we're going to share some of our top highlights with those guidelines. So let's go ahead and dive right into it. Natalie, can you tell us a little bit about what is happening in the world with the celebrities using our diabetes drugs for weight loss?
So let's go back a little bit. So these drugs are used for weight loss in patients without diabetes. Semaglutide is actually marketed to patients for weight loss and called the brand name of Wegovy. The exact same drug is sold to patients with diabetes with the brand name of Ozempic. It's just different dosing and actually a different pen mechanism, but it is the exact same molecule in those two different pens. So it isn't like everyone here and there is all of a sudden doing this. It's just that now it's out in public and it really does work as weight loss, right? The data is pretty impressive. So when the concerns start, when patients who don't need weight loss, who don't qualify for weight loss, start taking a medication that may actually cause more problems.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating because we've seen articles like in the Wall Street Journal, a lot of news outlets saying, are these celebrities, are they kind of taking it away from people that need it, people with diabetes? Because we know there's been shortages recently. There's been shortages of Wegovy, the semaglutide for weight loss, for a while. And then more recently, there's been shortages of Ozempic and the higher doses, the 2 milligrams. And even sometimes the 1 milligram. And then more recently, I've heard there's even been some shortages of Trulicity, dulaglutide. So do you think that the celebrities or other people are taking the drugs away from the people that need it?
I mean, I certainly think that this could be part of the problem, right? So it's yet another hype. And is it, do they work? Absolutely. These drugs work. They really do. I mean, you and I both, when we saw the data from the weight loss studies, we're just taken back by it, right? That's how well they work. If we're running out of things that patients need, you know, especially when you're looking at Trulicity or Ozempic, or specifically created for patients with diabetes, with that as an approval, the FDA approval, then that worries me because the drugs do something else besides weight loss. They reduce the risk of cardiovascular events, major adverse cardiovascular events. So we use these, especially in endocrinology. I prescribe more and more every day. And I say to patients, my job is to protect your heart. My job is to protect your organs. You know, this is the drug of choice to start with. This is the class of medications to start with. So when you hear of someone who you've seen a picture of someplace and they, you know, they don't qualify for that BMI. So the weight loss category is BMI greater than 27 with a comorbid condition. And that would be something like hyperlipidemia or hypertension, right? Or a BMI of 30 with no, or diabetes, right? Or a BMI of 30 with no comorbid condition. That's where they use it. And is BMI the perfect way to do it? No, we know this, but it is what it is, right? So now you have someone with a BMI of 24 that would like a BMI of 21 that's willing to pay cash. And these drugs are very expensive cash price, and but they've got the money, so they do it. That can be frustrating for both the patient as well as the provider, because we are kind of scrambling right now, trying to get patients to the weight loss drugs that we need them to be, and to the use of the GLP-1s that we're trying to get them to use, because they're at such high risk for cardiovascular complications.
Right. I think that's the thing. It's like, if someone's BMI is already under 25, do they need the drug? Is it safe to use? We don't actually know, because the drugs haven't been studied in people with BMIs that are in the normal weight category. So we don't really know what'll happen, but based on its mechanism of action, I feel comfortable that it's a lot safer than some of the weight loss drugs that have been used in the past that have had cardiac issues, you know, affecting the heart. These drugs, like you mentioned, have the cardiovascular benefits. And so right. I think safety-wise, long-term, at least they're a lot safer than drugs we've seen used in the past. And I've had some questions, well, is it going to cause hypoglycemia or low blood sugar in someone without diabetes? And fortunately, based on its mechanism, it only increases insulin production when glucose is high. And so in someone, when their glucose is normal, it's not expected to increase the insulin production, and therefore it does not cause hypoglycemia or low sugar. So that part is very good. So
right. It's much more safe, right? I mean, that's really what this comes down to. It's not going to cause, you know, it's not that fen-phen that that people were using that was causing all kinds of heart issues, right? The other concern is, where does this bring into disordered eating, right? Where does this, you know, it really does blunt that satiety, right? So these patients are feeling, you know, satiety at an earlier stage, so they're eating less, and that's helping. It also reduces, you know, it slows down the digestion in the stomach. So there's a couple of mechanisms that happen at the same time that this works. But what if you have a BMI of 23 or 24 and you want to be a BMI of 18 or 17? And then what have we done? Have we increased your risk of other things because of your weight? Is it osteoporosis? Is it, we don't know, right? So those are that, you know, and you can feel the patients being irate, the patients with diabetes saying, we're suffering enough. Could you just give us the drugs that we know work? Right. And they, So hopefully the shortages will work themselves out in the next handful of months.
I have two concerns. One is related to, so with the long-term use. So I think we've seen so far it's safe for long-term use. However, we do know from previous studies that once the drug is discontinued, usually that leads to rebound weight gain.
Absolutely.
So are people planning to commit to taking this for life? And we know that rebound, go basically yo-yoing, losing a bunch of weight, then gaining it and losing and regaining, that's really not a healthy pattern. So that is one concern that I have. Related to the shortages, I'm actually not so concerned about the shortages, because if they're not going to be covered if they're totally off label, right? So it's not like insurance plans are eating the cost of this. People are paying out of pocket $1,000 a month. Most people don't have that kind of extra money laying around. So therefore, it's the celebrities, it's the people that are making lots and lots of money. So I think if the demand is there, the production is going to go up. And ultimately, getting the, you know, everyone receiving full price for the drugs will put more money into everything. And I think the supply issue, like you said, will work themselves out. So I don't think they're stealing it from people with diabetes or people that are in dire need of it. But I would really like to see increased access for people with overweight and obesity that really need these drugs. So, but that often, those are payer issues, that people that do truly qualify for them don't have insurance coverage and don't have $1,000 just laying around to be able to buy it each month.
And I will tell you, I have had patients ask me to write off label, right? So, or to ask me to, so that doesn't work. And we know that, right? And then the other ask is, well, just tell them I have diabetes. And I want our viewers to understand what that means. If a patient comes to me or you and says, I have thyroid issues, I take thyroid medicine, my thyroid is normal, but I'm overweight, right? My BMI is 32 and I want weight loss medication. And we try to get it and it gets denied because the insurance company refuses to cover it. And lots of people are in that situation. Well, right, just tell them I have diabetes. And I need people to understand what that does. If a patient, first of all, I can't lie on a chart, I can't say you have diabetes if you don't, right? It's like, I can't tell you you have cancer if you don't. But the other side of that is if I put diabetes as a diagnosis down on your chart, and 5 years later, you'd like life insurance, for example, you can't get it. You can't get extra life insurance once you have a diagnosis of diabetes anywhere. So now do you really want that diagnosis on your chart? Probably not. So I spend time with lots of people who come to me for other endocrine issues who want weight loss, discussing the fact that I can't put a diagnosis of diabetes onto a chart that doesn't exist so that you can get, you know, a GLP-1 for weight loss, right? We just cannot do that. It's the wrong answer. And clinically, we have to do the right thing for every patient every time. That's not the right thing.
Right. Yeah. Great, great points. And hopefully we'll see submissions in the future for other drugs like Mounjaro for weight loss. And then hopefully it'll be more accessible for people without diabetes as well. I want to switch gears a little bit and make sure we have time to discuss some of the guidelines. So the first one I want to talk about are the new ADA KDIGO, Diabetes Management and Chronic Disease. So I first of all, think it's great that two major organizations are coming together to make sure their guidelines are streamlined and they're in agreement, because there can be a lot of confusion when there's different organizations putting out different guidelines. There's so many good nuggets in here, but one of them that I was particularly interested in that I thought was great to see was about SGLT2 inhibitors. So what it says is that an SGLT2 inhibitor with proven kidney or cardiovascular benefit is recommended for patients with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, with a GFR all the way down to 20. So, Natalie, what do you think about that?
So I think we've spent the last handful of years going back and forth about which one do I use and which one is the right one. And does this GFR, and what we have done in our practice is say, which is the least expensive for you? I don't look at, it doesn't matter. And ultimately what we've discovered is it really doesn't matter which one we use, which is what these guidelines say. They don't say pick the one. So we want the least expensive for the patient, right? And sometimes there is a little bit of a decision-making in there. So of, you know, there's canagliflozin has a little bit more of an SGLT, like a 1-2 combination. So it's a little stronger, we kind of call it. So is that, you know, so there is some tweaking in there, but overall they want you to use one, period. So if you're uncomfortable, pick the lower dose to start with. You don't have to do the walloping doses, right? So that's the first thing. The other thing that I thought was amazing is that initiate with a GFR greater than 20 and don't stop it. Don't stop it until there's dialysis or a transplant. And that's new, because we used to say, okay, if you start to approach 15, if you start to get too low, then take it away. Now we leave patients on it. And I think that's a really important difference.
Yeah. And this is something that's evolved over time, because yes, when these drugs first came out, there was concern that do they cause damage on the kidneys? And then they did all these studies to show, no, they don't cause damage. They're beneficial. And it used to be that GFR of 45 was kind of that strict cutoff, especially right, for glucose levels, because when GFR goes less than 45, they have a much more minimal impact on glucose. And that still is true. So that's an important consideration. If someone's A1C is high, other time and range is below, it's not a goal, yes, you still want to use these for the kidney benefit, but you're probably going to need another therapy to help them get into the glucose targets as well. But it's great to see, like, just clear that, yes, down to GFR of that 20, you can feel comfortable to start. They also do have a chart in here about the labeling of each of the drugs and what it says in terms of, like, DAPA initiation not recommended with GFR below 25, because that's in the label, EMPA GFR of 20. I think it's a little risky to have that chart because it changes so frequently, but at least that's up to date as of today, as of right now. So that's, it's just so, so great to see that.
Absolutely. And I love the idea that, you know, the top of this treatment guideline is diet, exercise, smoking cessation, and weight management too. Right. So again, kidney disease, we need to do all of those other things as well. And I'm impressed with this. I really am.
Yeah. And they also, right, in that algorithm, it's very clear, like, what the first line therapies are, that SGLT2 inhibitor, usually in combination with metformin if the GFR is over 30, making sure that an ACE inhibitor or an ARB is used and is at maximum tolerated dose.
And then
if a person has hypertension.
Yep, absolutely. And then if your glucose control isn't there, use a GLP-1.
Yeah.
Right. Isn't that interesting that we're now flipping, aren't we? We're saying use an SGLT2, but with heart, you know, we can do that. And with GLP-1, so we're kind of doing it back and forth now, right? These are the drugs of choice. These should be your drugs of choice after metformin or before metformin, depending on who you are and where you practice and what the insurance company says. But a lot of times we are using metformin plus something else immediately upon diagnosis.
Right. And also in this algorithm, the prominent place of finerenone.
Yes.
So if we basically, you make sure those first line therapies are there and then additional risk-based therapy, and there's a prominent place for finerenone. If the urine albumin to creatinine ratio is over 30. So that is great to see. It's very clear in the guidelines. And one other thing I like about this algorithm is it separates type 1 and type 2. So there's like often, I don't know, there's confusion. Like, what do you do for type 1 diabetes? And so they've actually color coded the algorithm where green is type 2 diabetes and then the blue is type 1 diabetes. So you understand which to use for which. Of course, in the real world, we do often use type 2 diabetes drugs and type 1 diabetes. And perfect examples are off-label use of SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 agonists. And even finerenone is FDA approved for type 2 diabetes, but really it just hasn't been studied in type 1 diabetes. But I think we're going to start seeing some increased off-label use in type 1 diabetes because people with type 1 diabetes also want to protect their kidneys. And in my mind, there's no reason to believe it wouldn't be effective for people with type 1 diabetes. But of course, that is an off-label indication right now.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. I mean, we use, you know, and are we part of the GLP-1, you know, shortage problem just using it with our type 1s, right? I mean, are we creating some of the problem too? But if a patient with type 1 presents that is overweight or obese, that is insulin resistant, that is, isn't that the greatest use for a GLP-1? It's not FDA approved, but we do it all the time because I'm trying to protect their organs. I'm trying to protect their kidneys and their hearts, right? So, you know, we use other drugs off label as well. So this is nothing new to any of us, but I do believe that we as clinicians have to make the safest decision for the patient and review the side effect profile, and the things that would go with this. What are you looking for? What could show a sign of an issue or a side effect that would what would you need to do next, right? With all of the medications.
Right. Yeah. And this has a nice chart in it too about
it does.
Some of the clinical pearls with the different medications, like additional side effects to watch out for in people with kidney disease and how you would dose adjust other medications like metformin too for people with kidney disease. Yeah. Anything else you want to add on that? Or should we go to the next guideline?
I think the big thing is, you know, you say, okay, the KDIGO guidelines, but I don't know that everyone knows what KDIGO stands for. So KDIGO is kidney disease, improving global outcomes. That's what KDIGO stands for. So this is the consensus report from the American Diabetes Association. And it's the management of chronic kidney disease. So we call it the KDIGO guidelines. So just so you know where that came from, I think it's important.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, right. We just kind of throw out these terms and we're just like, everyone should know, everyone knows that.
Right.
But yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about our next one. So automated insulin delivery. So if anyone listened to our last episode, we actually talked about a consensus statement then, but it was a different one. So we have so many things coming out recently. So the one previously we discussed was called the consensus recommendation for use of automated insulin delivery technologies in clinical practice. That's a guideline that has just a lot of clinical pearls. It also talks about all the different devices, both in the US and outside the US. This recent one was actually a consensus report of the Joint Diabetes Technology Working Group of EASD, which stands for European Association for the Study of Diabetes, and ADA, the American Diabetes Association. This is specifically called Automated Insulin Delivery, Benefits, Challenges, and Recommendations. And I think this one's a little bit more targeted, specifically talking about the benefits, challenges. So, Natalie, anything really pop out at you from this new guideline or this new consensus report?
So I think they did a really good job covering in general what the challenges are, right? And what the technology is that's available and what we wish it would do. But one of my favorite parts is actually the second page, which is the AID systems terminology. So just like when we just said KDIGO guidelines, KDIGO, and you and I are just like, oh yeah, the kidney guidelines, right? Other people don't know what that is. And the first table that the guidelines start with is the terminology. And as Diana and I were talking about this before this filming, we're using the wrong terminology, and we do, this is our job every day, and we're calling things the wrong thing. So I think that the first thing we have to do if we're going to get this to move forward consistently is have all the clinicians talk the same vernacular around some of these things. So we were calling sensor augmented pumps, pumps that would suspend, and they're not. So their definition, for example, of sensor augmented pumps is a pump that displays glucose data, and it doesn't suspend or increase insulin, right? So that would be a patient's on brand X, but they use brand Y CGM and they don't talk to each other, but the data is either on the pump or separate, but the sensor, the patient is using the pump and the sensor data in their own brain. Think about that as the patient's brain is having to operate. So if they saw their sensor going up, they would decide whether or not to give a little more insulin based on that number, do whatever. It's all patient brain and sensor augmented pumps. So yeah, Diana, do you want to go over? Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's such a great point because I recently wrote a paper about automated insulin delivery with Dr. Kathy Zoe. And we were struggling on this point. We're like, what's a sensor augmented pump? Because there were different definitions in the literature. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I previously thought sensor augmented pump was any pump that had connectivity with CGM, which could include AID and pumps that just is suspend with when they go low. And this is basically saying, no, it is just the simplest form of like the old Animas pumps, for example, that displayed it, but didn't do anything with the number. So this is like that simplest form. Someone's wearing CGM, someone has a pump. And now we've got a separate definition for low glucose suspend or predictive low glucose suspend for a pump that just does that. For example, like the Basal IQ Tandem. And then the separate automated insulin delivery or the hybrid closed loop. So I think this is important. So we're all on the same page. We're all using the same definition. So I agree with you. I'm so glad to see that. Another area that really pops out for me was the inclusion of the CARES framework in this guideline. So the CARES framework is something that was developed by Laurel Messer and colleagues at Barbara Davis. And we actually incorporated it into our AID consensus paper as well. But I'm so glad to see that it's being included in multiple places. So Natalie, I know you utilize it too in practice. Do you want to tell listeners what it's like, kind of what it's all about?
Yep. So hang on, let me pull up the page. So the CARES framework basically says, what does the algorithm that you're using do? As a clinician, you need to know what that algorithm does, right? How does it calculate the insulin delivery? And what are the components that are comprised of that, right? And then how can the user adjust? A is for adjust. How can the user adjust that delivery? So if you're on some AID systems and you change the basal, it does nothing. So you say to the patient, oh, you're having some lows. I'm going to change the basal. You haven't fixed anything. Right? So that's a big part of it. You need to know what your changes are as a clinician so that then you make the changes that are going to help prevent low blood sugars or spikes or whatever, right? And then revert. When should the patient revert back? If you see what kind of problem, should you go back to turning off this automated insulin delivery? So that's the revert, that's R. And then E is educate. Where are the key education points for the advanced diabetes device? So what do you need to recommend? I tell you every day, every single day with almost every patient I see, bolusing before the meal becomes such an, I mean, because the AID systems bring your blood sugars down overnight, right? They do a beautiful job of those. All of the ones on the market do a good job of that. Some differently than others, but they all bring them down. And then you see this spike for breakfast and it comes right back down. And it's like, you're taking the right amount because you went up and came back down again and you hit the target goal again, but your timing is wrong. The glucose went in and then the insulin caught up, and that's what that curve is. So I spend a lot of time talking about those kinds of things, and that's a big education point. Another is to tell the patient the same thing. You need to charge your pump, or you need to do this with it, or putting it in sleep mode, or putting it in auto mode, or exercise, you know, those kinds of things. When and how to do that will help them. And then finally, the sensoring sharing. S is for sensor share. So the CARES framework, S is for sensor share. And that is, what are relevant sensor characteristics for each device? And what are the system capabilities for remote monitoring and cloud-based data sharing? So if I can get someone to remote bolus using Tandem, for example, that's automatically uploading to my chart, like to my Tandem program. So the T-Connect, when I downloaded it, is already there. I don't really care if a patient remote boluses, but I really want them to, so that the data is there already, right? So keep the T-Connect app open has not been as great a motivator as bolus from your phone, right? So we're having more patients just do that, right? I just need you to bolus once a day from your phone. You're going to love it in the end. Whereas if I can get the patient, when they start on Omnipod, to set their glucose up correctly, then that's automatically uploading, right? So, right. And when does it happen and how does it happen? The same with the new Medtronic pump, the 770, it's doing it automatically, but you have to set it up correctly. So knowing how to set this up so that if a patient sends a message through their portal or calls your clinic and says, I'm having a problem, and then you, Diana, have to call them back and say, well, I can't see your data since August 13th. We've done all this work and now we can't see them. So what this is all, the CARES framework says, get them set up for success long-term, because someone's going to get an injection in their shoulder, or someone's going to have an issue where they're on crutches for a while and get less exercise, or need to get a significant more amount of exercise because they're going someplace wonderful. We need to be able to, as clinicians, jump into their data, look at it, help them make changes, and then go about their life so that they can thrive with diabetes.
Right. Yeah. So I agree. I love that framework. It's so helpful. And in the first paper that you mentioned, that one goes through with the pumps what specific changes you can make so you can apply it, because that's often, there's a lot of confusion there. There's a nice chart in that one. One just kind of last thing I wanted to mention about this paper that I think is nice that wasn't included in the other one is DIY looping. And I know we've talked about this in the past because there was that recent randomized controlled trial with it, but they do address it head on in here. They talk about it, the potential safety issues with it not being FDA approved, but then how clinicians can support people with diabetes that are utilizing these systems, and some of the challenges, like not having, like having the complexity of setting up the systems and then relying on kind of social support for troubleshooting versus like having actual tech support. But it's great that they address those issues kind of head on. I'm glad to see that.
I am so happy to see that, because it's happening. And for us to pretend there's an elephant in the room that we're not addressing, I don't think is fair for our patients, right? Again, we're their advocates. So if that's what they're going to choose to use to get their insulin into their bodies, whether we're proponents of it or not, we do need to be able to support them.
Yeah. So I know we've talked about a lot of stuff today. The last guideline that we just wanted to let listeners know that is out there is through ACE, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology. And it's developing a diabetes mellitus comprehensive care plan 2022 update. So the previous one was from 2015. So this is a very comprehensive, important update. It is 123 pages. So it's very detailed. I mean, it's got everything in there, but it's going to be a little hard for us to summarize. So we may provide some summaries in the future, but just to let everyone know, in early 2023, it's expected that ACE will be coming out with their algorithm, which is like a nice, that's usually a nice comprehensive document. And it has these slides that go with it that are really great visualizations that have like the whole hierarchy of medications to prescribe and anything. So stay tuned for that. But wanted to let everyone know that's out there so that you're aware. This is just such a fast moving field. So thanks everyone for listening today. I know that was a lot of information, and we will see you next time.
Take care.